We are very privileged to have us with us here, Rivi Frankel. Some of you might know her. She did one of the Nachiyomi Siyums. She is a tour guide and knows history very well. And I was thinking about, I really wanted someone who could give us a little bit of a deeper understanding of the history and what was really going on behind the scenes, like we talked about before, during the Hanukkah story. And so someone recommended Rivi Frankel. And I'm happy that she was able to make it. Rivi Frankel is the director of programming of Matan's Bellows Eshkolot Fellowship. She has a BS in management and a master's in education, Jewish education from the Hebrew University. She's a licensed tour guide through the Ministry of Tourism. She lives in Yerushalayim, teaches in Medreshet Emunah Omanut and Matan, and guides various educational groups throughout Israel. So you can start speaking and we'll highlight you.
All right, good morning, everybody. Chodesh Tov. I'm very excited to be here. So thank you, Zamira, for reaching out. I myself have been a participant of this program many times. And I think that it is quite incredible and inspirational to see the amount of women that come together on Rosh Chodesh to be able to learn and uplift ourselves. So thank you for being here this morning. As Zamira said, so we're going to focus a little bit on the historical background of what was going on with Hanukkah. It's very funny. So I'm not sure. I think a lot of you are probably familiar with the organization that used to be called JWRP, that's now called Momentum. And they bring women from literally all over the world. I don't even know how many countries to come to Israel for 8 days. It's kind of like birthright for moms. And it's one of my favorite groups to guide. The energy is just so electric when these women come together. You're talking anywhere between 200 and 600 women, sometimes in the same room, and it's very, very powerful. And so I was once guiding a group that, including on the bus, was a group from Greece. And the first thing that I found very, very interesting was every time I would highlight, we were standing on the top of Masada, and I was like, this is a 2,000-year-old water cistern. And all the Americans are like, wow, 2,000 years old. And we talk about the Kotel, and I'd be like, we even have a wall that's older than the Kotel in the Old City. It's 2,700 years old. And one of the Greek women said to me, she's like, what's the significance between, like, why do you always stress how old things are? 2,000 years, 2,700 years old. So I said, the truth is, coming as I'm a Canadian American, we don't have things that old. So it's really exciting for us. She's like, oh, that's like also down the block, up the street. Like in Greece, they also have a lot of old things like they do in Israel. And so for them, they weren't impressed. So I was like, all right, I'm going to have to like really work hard to impress these women. And as I was talking about some of the historical pieces that have to do with Greece, I would say, and the Greeks, and they would get, I could see that there was like some sort of angst that was going on in the group. So I finally turned to one of the women and I said, am I telling the history wrong? She's like, those were not the Greeks. I'm thinking to myself, like running through my head and all the different things that, like, who were these people? How did I mess this up? And she says, those were the Hellenists. And it was so critical for them to make a distinction between the Greeks and the Hellenists, because they, part of their identity is Greek. And yet the story of the Hellenists and the story of ancient Greece is so divorced and so far removed from where they identify, especially as Jewish women, that it was hard for them to hear them being referred to as the Greeks as opposed to the Hellenists. And that taught me a really important lesson. And I think that is also going to be part of what we're going to focus on today, which is, what is the question of identity? Are you Greek? Are you Jewish? Are you a Hellenist? What does that mean? How do we define it? And how did they define it in history, in ancient times? I think is going to play a very big role in our understanding of Hanukkah today, not just as a holiday, and not just as a way to inspire ourselves, but as a way to understand our place in history, and a way to kind of look at what's going on in current events and seeing how we can learn and how we can adjust ourselves and make ourselves better Ovdei Hashem, make ourselves better people through this understanding. So that's my goal. I understand that it's a little lofty, but hopefully we will be able to accomplish it. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. If you give me 1 second, I'm actually, spoiler alert, this is a coin. But we're going to start a little bit further back. So let's get started. Here we go. So here we have a bust of Alexander III of Macedon, which more famously known as Alexander the Great. Now, he lived between 356 and 323 BCE. Just as kind of a putting ourselves into history, this is before the time period of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is going to happen at around 165 BCE. Now, BCE is when we're counting backwards, so I know it gets a little confusing, so I made sure to bring the dates, and we're going to have timelines. If you have questions as we go along, you're welcome to throw them in the chat. I'm not sure if I'm going to see them, but I definitely will take questions at the end, so make sure to write them down, or I'm happy to clarify or to talk about larger issues as well. And this is really where we're going to start our story. And the reason that we're starting our story with Alexander the Great, as opposed to the story of Hanukkah, is because Alexander the Great is actually the person who's responsible for what we call today Hellenism. Now, what do I mean by that? So he was 19 years old when his father dies and he takes over the empire. And very, very quickly, in a matter of 10 years, Alexander the Great is able to stretch to basically the biggest empire that the ancient world has seen. So if you take a look at this picture over here, so we have a map. So here we're starting in the area of Greece. Now, what's really, really interesting is that very often when we think Greece and we think the capital of Greece, we think of Athens, and Athens being the seat of culture that we have when we think of ancient Greece. And yet Athens at this point has already been on the decline as the center of Greek culture and the seat of Greek government. And in fact, like we said, that Alexander the Great is called Alexander the Third of Macedon. So Macedonia, which is further up this way to the northwest, is actually where the seat of power is during this time. And so while Athens is what we hear of, Macedon, which is another region of Greece, is really the one that is in control at this time. And very, very quickly, Alexander the Great is able to leverage his father Philip's army. They were very well trained. They were very effective at what they did. And you can see that they really stretch out all the way down to what today is Asia. They really made their way into Asia, parts of North Africa. And so we see here, this is Egypt going up into North Africa, and more importantly for our purposes, here we have the land of Israel. And so the land of Israel is taken over by Alexander the Great. Now, why is this important for our story of Hanukkah? Because this is when Hellenism begins. Because if we take a look, this is a bust that was found, that is today homed in a museum in Berlin, of Isocrates. Now, Isocrates was a very well-known rhetoric and philosopher in Greece. He's one of what's called the 10 Attic speakers. He was more of a writer than he was a speaker, although we do have a number of his speeches that he's written. Not so much, we don't really know very much about the speeches that he delivers. And so what does he say in the fourth century? And so the same time period that we're talking about with Alexander the Great. And if a man should partake of our culture, let him be called a Hellen. So all of a sudden, we have a different definition of identity. Until this point, your identity was where you lived. If you were Egyptian, your identity was Egyptian. If you lived in the area of what, the Assyrians, so then your identity was Assyrian. If you lived in Judah, your identity was a Judean. If you lived in Lebanon, right, or you were a Sidonian, Sor, Sidon, all of these areas depended on where you lived. Now, we know already, as learners of history and as people who follow the Jewish calendar, that the Ten Shvatim were exiled, and that the Assyrians had a model where, in order to make everybody Assyrian, they would do a population swap. So they would take people A from land A, and they would put them in land B. They would take people from land B and put them into land C, and they would take those people from land C and put them into land A. And the reason the Assyrians did that was because they wanted the culture and the population to not feel comfortable where they were and to become Assyrian. But as soon as the Assyrian Empire falls, there's no longer Assyrians. But the idea of Hellenism, or the idea of what Socrates calls being a Hellen, is a cultural identity. It doesn't have to do with who's ruling you. It doesn't have to do with where you live. And you can self-subscribe to this identity, which changes the way that people see identity. And it really affects us even today. I can choose, am I a communist? Am I a socialist? No, I'm neither of those things. But are whatever those things are, I can choose which, am I a Democrat? Am I a Republican? All of, I can choose what my identity is. And even so far to say it in what is tragic in a very real sense is that if you talk to, there was a Pew study done in 2013 that followed Jews mostly in North America, but specifically in the United States, where asking questions about Jews and their Jewish identity. And most people who, especially people who didn't grow up in a religious framework, so conservative and Orthodox people tended to answer differently than unaffiliated Jews and Reform Jews, but they see their identity as being something that you can opt into. Judaism has become a cultural identity for many of today's Jews. And so I see this all the time when I guide groups like Birthright or I take college groups around, is that in the same way that they can opt out of parts of Judaism, people can opt into Judaism. And if you think of yourself as a Jew, then you're a Jew. And that is all because of the influence of this culture that Alexander the Great's empire brings to the world. Now, what's really fascinating is that we actually as Jews had seen this on a slightly different scale before we have the idea of Hellenism, because Avraham Avinu gave us a spiritual identity and anybody could opt into it, right? Before there was a concept of being a Jew, a Yehuda, Har Sinai, the nation, Avram had the people, right? We say, Avram et gayaret et anashim, v'sarah et gayaret et anashim, right? Anybody who came to the tent of Avram and Sarah, they were able to become part of this identity. They could opt in to the identity of monotheism. And so we see on a religious level that there is an idea of being able to self-identify, right? And we got that from Abraham. But in terms of culture, this is a very, very new idea that we have in the times of the Greeks. So after Alexander the Great dies, his generals, they have a big dispute about who's gonna take over him. It's not like what happened with him where his father was in charge and then after that he became in charge, or his brother or whatever it was, the generals made a coup and they took over. And the most famous that we talk about, or that maybe we can identify, especially because it has to do with the story of Eretz Israel, is the Seleucid Empire, who was the general Seleucus, and the Ptolemaic Empire, which was Ptolemy. And so the Ptolemaic Empire, as we can see here, is down in Egypt, right? Alexandria was the capital, as opposed to the Seleucid Empire, where we have Antioch as the capital. If you've ever read the book As a Driven Leaf, which I highly recommend, I probably reread this book every 2-3 years, and I get something else out of it. It's the story of Elisha ben Abuya, who also in the Gemara is called Acher. And in this story, it's historical fiction, but it's very, very well researched. And the story basically confronts exactly the question that we deal with Hanukkah, although this is a little bit of a later time period. And the question that it discusses is how or can you adopt or inculcate Greek logic, Roman logic, into a Jewish way of thinking? And it really addresses this question head on. But in the middle of the book, the main character goes to Antioch. He goes there and it talks about being the seat of culture. In the Ptolemaic Empire, in Alexandria, in Egypt, it was much more, as we would say today, chill. What do I mean by that? The citizens, you could be part of things, you could not be part of things. You didn't have to completely identify with the culture in order to take part in what was going on. That was not really the case in the Seleucid Empire. In the Seleucid Empire, it was a much more all-encompassing, once you were in, and you couldn't really believe anything else, at least publicly, without being shamed or ostracized, or even in a context of jobs that you would get, or things like that. Now that's gonna become really important in our story and in the story of Hanukkah. The other thing that I'd like to point out that is important for our story is the Nabataeans. Now the Nabataeans don't directly connect to Hanukkah, but if anybody's been to Petra before, so Petra was built by the Nabataeans. They started off almost like Bedouins. They were a nomadic tribe, very, very important in the spice trade, right? They were able to, in today what's the Sinai Desert, so they were able to navigate and to spend long times in the desert. They're a separate entity. They're not connected really to what's going on. Yes, they're affected by it, but they're not connected to the Seleucids and the Ptolemies and the Antigonoids and all that kind of stuff. they're going to become important in the story of King Herod, because King Herod's mother is actually Nabataean. And so is he considered halachically Jewish or not? Did she convert? Yes or no? And it's also going to be important in the times of the Romans, because Masada is going to be built where it is. And really even the end of the Hashmonai period, because the Nabataeans are becoming an empire. And as opposed to being a small, nomadic, very wealthy tribe, they're starting, and even here you can see the amount of land that they have. So in the Negev today, you can see Nabataean ruins, Nabataean cities that develop through the time period later in the Nabataeans, and not really for our story, but they are going to become a significant player on the world stage, and we are going to hear that Nabataean identity come up as we go through history. And so as we're saying, basically, the land of Israel belongs mostly to the Ptolemies. And so at that time, what was happening was that the Jewish people, while there was an influx of this Hellenistic culture, they could still be Jews. And this is something that we see today very, very often. But before we continue talking about that, I just want to show us the timeline, because I feel like things get a little complicated. And so for those of you that are visual learners, just to show you what we're talking about. So 175 is when Antiochus I, or what is called Antiochus Epiphanes, becomes king of the Seleucid Empire over here. Now, his father, Antiochus III, actually fights against the Ptolemies, and he wins for the first time. There's something in history that is called the Six Syrian Wars, and that's the wars that primarily take place between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And in this war that goes on, so there are six of them, they go back and forth, winners, losers, but right before Antiochus becomes king, here in 175, his father, Antiochus III, is able to capture Eretz Yisrael, and now it's under his control. And we see within 10 years of Antiochus IV becoming king, and that's the Antiochus that we know and love to hate, right? So within 10 years of Antiochus becoming king, we have the Maccabi Revolt. What's the Maccabi Revolt? That's the story of Hanukkah. So 10 years after Antiochus becomes king, that's when we see the big revolt in the time of the Greeks. Now, what's also really important to point out here is that even before 165, even before Matathiahu HaKohen stands up and says, Mila Hashem Elai, who's going to fight the Greeks? We see that the Yerushalayim temple is looted. We see that an altar to Zeus, which obviously is a Avodah Zarah, is set up in the Beit HaMikdash. So we see that there are these slow steps, and history is not clear on why exactly those steps take place. So let's take a look at this map. This map is actually, I'm sorry that it's not so, it's a little bit pixelated, but for our purposes, it's okay. Where were the Jews living at the time? So in 175, the Jews are in Yehuda. Yehuda is this light pink area. I mean, Yehuda also extends down here, Lachish, Hebron, we know obviously is Yehuda. David had his capital there for 70 years, all the way down to Beersheba, right? But where are the Jews primarily living? In the times of Hanukkah, in the times of Antiochus, in this area of Yerushalayim. Obviously, we also know Modi'in, so we spread out a little bit that way, but primarily the Jews are living in Yehuda. The rest of what's going on up here in the northern part of the country is non-Jews. So the Samaritans, for example, we have Greek cities that are beginning to develop. If any of you have been to Caesarea, so Caesarea was built by King Herod in the Roman times, but it was built there because there was something called Stratton's Tower, which was actually built in the time of the Greeks, because the port is going to be important. The port of Jaffa is going to be important. All of these areas are going to be important in terms of the trade that's coming into this area, especially again, if we're thinking about Greece being over here. So this port area is going to be significant for the Greeks that are living here, but the Jews are primarily living in this area. And the Jews of Yehuda are not super Hellenized, or at least that's the picture that most of the historians like to take. There's a debate in history about whether or not all of the Jews were starting to turn towards Hellenism. And when I say all the Jews, I mean Jews from all sections of society, because we know obviously it wasn't all the Jews, because that's why there was a revolt, right? But was it Jews from all sectors? Was it, even if you were poor, or even if you were middle class, or you were whatever you were, it could be that your neighbor was Hellenized? Or, as most of what the historians believe, it was the elite. at this time, the elite are talking about rich merchants, but also about the priest class, the Kohanim. The Kohanim are very powerful at this time in terms of their influence on the people, and they also have a lot of money. And so, is it just the elite class, or is it the everyday Yehudim that is possibly going to be Hellenized? We're not 100% sure at this time. We know for sure it was the elite class, and it's possible that that was also already starting to filter down into the other places. Now, if we're already looking at this map, so you can see that after the Hashmonaim take control, right? It's the last time that we had independent Jewish rule in the land of Israel until 1948, right? Until the Declaration of Independence of this modern state of Israel. So until that time, this was the last time that we had independent Jewish rule. And in fact, you can see that the Hashmonaim were able to expound on the boundaries of Yerushalayim, of Israel, the expanse that they had control of was enormous. We're talking about already paralleling the time of Shlomo HaMelech, which is very, very, very significant. All of these areas become places where Jews are living in the times of the Greeks and then later in the times of the Romans. And we know, of course, post-Chorban, that because there is relative peace in the Galil, that's where the Sanhedrin is going to go, right, to Tiberia and into that area. And that's going to become very significant. But at the time of Hanukkah, most Jews are living here in the light pink, where you're able, where you can see this light pink area. Now, I want to look at the sources of history of the revolt and what caused it, and was this big debate that's talking about the Hellenists being the elite or the regular people is going to play a very important role in understanding why Hanukkah really happened. But before we do that, I want to talk about the Sefer Chitzoniyot, the Apocrypha, as they're called, or the external books. What does that mean? So the external books are these books that were not canonized. They were not put in our 24 books of Tanakh, and yet they might have existed at the time or slightly after the time that Tanakh was closed. And the question that is very often asked is, why aren't these books included in the canon of Tanakh? But there's an even more, I think, extreme question, which we're going to look at here in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, is just one place that it deals with it, which is the question of, if they weren't included in Tanakh, forget why they weren't included in Tanakh, if they weren't included in Tanakh, am I allowed to learn them? So we're going to read this source of Gemara in English. For those of you that are not familiar with my source sheets, or in general, this, I copied this, obviously, this is not my translation. So the bolded words are the exact translation of the Gemara, and the non-bolded words are there to kind of help fill in so that we can understand. Of course, we have to know that every single translation is also an opinion on the text, right? It's also a commentary on the text. But for our purposes, where we're not studying the Gemara, we're trying to get a historical sense or an overview, so a translation is really just going to be fine. The Mishnah teaches that Rabbi Akiva says, also one who reads external literature has no share in the world to come. External literature being Sfarim Chitzoniyim, right? You can see that at the top in the Hebrew over here. So anybody who reads these Sefer Chitzoniyot has no share in the world to come. Oh no, because my next source is the Makkabees. So hold on one second, because obviously there's going to be a continuation of this. The sages taught in a Braita. This is a reference to reading books of heretics. Right, so this is talking about the person who wrote the book was not a Yarei Shemayim. In fact, they not only did they not fear God, but they also were heretic, and they espoused views that were against what Torah views were. Rabbi Yossi says it's also prohibited to read the book of Ben Sira due to its problematic contents. Abaya says to Rabbi Yossi, what is the reason that it's prohibited to read the book of Ben Sira? If we say that it is prohibited due to the fact that Ben Sira wrote in it, do not flay the skin of fish from its ear so that the skin does not go to ruin, but roast it on the fire and eat it with two loaves of bread, and you believed it to be nonsense, that is not sufficient reason. So this quote is strange. And if we were studying the Gemara here, and if we were talking about Ben Sira, we would go more into this. And in fact, this continues on for another daf and let's say a half about the Ben Sira and Sefer Chitzoniyot. And what's interesting about Ben Sira is in this discussion is that they talk about, Ben Sira talks about illicit relationships very graphically, and it maybe even encourages some illicit relationships. And so it's interesting that we're going to start off with this fish and what's it talking about. Not really so relevant. Interesting question. So I will leave you with a little bit of a cliffhanger in that regard. You can definitely go look it up. There are a lot of really interesting Parsha Neiman articles that have been written about Ben Sira and this discussion in the Gemara. But what I wanted to really hit on here is that the content is what is problematic according to Rabbi Yosef, right? So Rabbi Akiva says anybody who reads these external literature has no share in the world to come. So we're talking about people who are reading things that are heretical, people that are learning them for different types of reasons than just learning the history. And it is a very accepted thing to read the Book of Maccabees. In fact, what's fascinating is there's actually something called Megillat Antiochus. We're not really sure who wrote it, but in Italy, sometime probably around the 13, 14, 1500s, they actually read this on Hanukkah in the same way that we read Megillat Esther. Now, I don't know if that means that they read it every single night. It's much shorter than Megillat Esther. It's 79 psukim, which I know sounds like weird because you think of a pasuk as a religious thing, but a pasuk just means a verse. So there are 79 verses. It's relatively short. You can look it up on Sepharia. It's one perspective of the Hanukkah story. We don't have a lot of information in our sources about the Hanukkah story. We have obviously the Gemara in Shabbos 25, right, where it talks about very, very quickly the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash. And then that's like two or three sentences. And then it goes on to all of the halachot of Hanukkah and the debate between Hillel and Shammai, right? A Mahadrim. But in terms of the actual story, the only place that we really have it written in is in the Sefer Chitzoniyim. And so we're going to take a look at it to try and get a historical message. We're not using this as a way to understand the religious messages. And I actually heard something very beautiful by Rev Aviyah Cohen, who lives in Alon Shvut. He teaches it in a number of different institutions. He really comes from a line of very illustrious Rabbanim, and he himself is included in that line. He only teaches in Hebrew, but I highly recommend if you have an opportunity to hear him. He really is, his Torah knowledge and application is just phenomenal. And one of the things that Rabbi Hakohen had when I had the schut of being in his class was that he said that when it comes to Sefer Chitzoniyim, what do you notice? That the narrative of humanity is much more gentle than the narrative of humanity when it comes to the Svarim of Tanakh. And on the one hand, you might think to yourself, well, if we look better as human beings, maybe that's a better Sefer to read. But he says the message of Tanakh is that human beings struggle. The message of Avram Avinu and Sodom, right? Where Avram Avinu is fighting with Hashem. How could you fight with Hashem? But that's the message. That's the spiritual inheritance that we receive from Avram Avinu. We want to change the world. Nobody's perfect. Everybody makes mistakes. Our history, both our spiritual history and our actual history, is replete with mistakes and then people doing tshuva. And what we see very often in the Sefer Chitzoniyim is that we don't have that model. And so that was his take on why we don't have Sefer Chitzoniyim. But either way, we are going to look at the story of Maccabees in order to try and get a sense of what's going on historically in the times of Hanukkah. So before we jump into I have a few sources from Maccabees that we're going to look at. I just wanted to show us there are actually eight different books. Now these books we do not have, you can see originally written in Hebrew and surviving in a Greek translation. We do not have the original Hebrew anymore. We don't know who wrote the book. We assume that it was written sometime around the story of Hanukkah, that it is actually a firsthand source of somebody who witnessed the events. But the reason that we were able to know what it says in Maccabees is actually because of the Septuagint. The Septuagint was the Greek translation of the Torah, and that is where most of these books are preserved. And so the original one, the one that was the historical one, is what is referred to as Maccabees 1. Then we have the second one, and you can, by the way, at the end of the year, if anybody wants, I'll give you my email, and I'm happy to share the slideshow with you, and you can go through and see what the differences are. Not really relevant, but just so you know, there are eight different Maccabee books. They're very significant in Christian religions, specifically in the Orthodox, like the Orthodox Christians, like that's Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, they tend to use other versions of Maccabees beyond just what the Catholic or the Protestants do. But for our purpose, we're going to actually be looking at Maccabees 1, Maccabees 2, which is a kind of rewriting summary. It says here an abridgment, right, of one. And then number four is a philosophical discussion over what really happened and what drove the Maccabees. So those are the ones that we're going to be looking at. So let's take a look now at our first source from Maccabees 4. Later, when King Seleucus dies, and Antiochus, known as Epiphanes, or I say it in the Hebrew break, but Epiphanes, became king, Jason, the brother of Onias. So Jason actually called himself Jason. His name was Yoshua or Yeshua, we're not sure. In the anglicized version, it said that his original name was Jesus. So we don't know if he was Yeshua or Yehoshua, we're not sure. The brother of Onias, which is Yohanan, the high priest, by corrupt means. So Jason, who called himself Jason, was a Hellenist. And he goes behind the back of his brother, Yohanan, and he gets appointed as the Kohen Gadol as a political appointment by the Greeks, which is really problematic. Note, though, which is going to be significant later on, that he is still from the family of the Kohen Gadol, which were usually from the family of Tzadok. And so here we see that the Greek ruling class was becoming involved in areas that until then, in the times of the Ptolemies, were left to the Jews' devices to rule on their own. And so the Greeks are becoming involved in the political and religious sphere of the Jewish people. He went to see the king and offered him 27,000 pounds of silver with 6,000 pounds, more pounds to be paid later. Jason also offered him an additional 11,250 pounds of silver for the authority to establish a stadium where young men could train and enroll the people of Jerusalem as citizens of Antioch. So what is Jason trying to do? Jason is trying to Hellenize the city. He's trying to make the city of Yerushalayim, of Yehuda, look like any other city in the Seleucid Empire or in the Greek Empire. So he's trying to take the culture and he's trying to put it in. Now, what do we see? He's not just taking the culture of the Greeks, but he's actually going against his brother, who not only was against Hellenists, but who was somebody who served Hashem. What Jason's goal, as opposed to Yohanan's goal, is to become a political figure as opposed to a spiritual leader. The king gave his approval, and just as soon as Jason took over the office of high priest, he made the people of Yerushalayim change to the Greek way of life. He began by abolishing the favors that John had secured for the Jews from previous kings. John was the father of Epaphras, who later went to Rome, not relevant for what we need to know. Jason also did away with our Jewish customs and introduced new customs that were contrary to our law. So notice that the person who's writing this book is writing it from the vantage point of being Jewish. With great enthusiasm, he built a stadium near the temple and led our finest young men to adopt Greek customs of participating in athletic events. Because of the unrivaled wickedness of Jason, that ungodly and illegitimate high priest, right? The author is making very clear his opinion on what's going on. The craze for the Greek way of life and foreign customs reached such a point that even the priests lost all interest in their sacred duties. They lost interest in the temple services and neglected the sacrifices. Just as soon as the signal was given, they would rush off to partake in games that were forbidden by our law. They did not care about anything their ancestors valued. They prized only Greek honors. And this turned out to be the source of all their troubles. For the very people, sorry, one of the bars is blocking, there we go. For the very people whose ways they admired and whose customs they tried to imitate became their enemies and oppressed them. It is a serious thing to disregard God's laws, as you see from the following events. So in this source that we're seeing, in this book of Maccabees, while it's true that Antiochus Epiphanes was part of the story, the Hellenism is actually coming from Jews themselves, right? It's not that it was put on them and they had to do. The culture of Hellenism was something that the Jews came to on their own. This is going to be very different than some of the other sources that we're going to see. So let's take a look now. Remember, this is Maccabees 1. So this was the one written by the historian as opposed to later people who didn't live at the time. The wicked ruler Antiochus Epiphanes, son of King Antiochus III of Syria, was a descendant of one of Alexander's generals. Antiochus Epiphanes had been a hostage in Rome before he became king of Syria in the year 137. At the time, there appeared in the land of Israel a group of traitorous Jews who had no regard for the law, meaning the Greek law, and who had bad influence on many of, meaning they had no regard for the Jewish law, and who had a bad influence on many of our people. They said, Let's come to terms with the Gentiles, for our refusal to associate with them has brought us nothing but trouble. This proposal appealed to many people, and some of them became so enthusiastic about it that they went to the king and received permission to follow his Gentile customs. They built in Jerusalem a stadium like those in the Greek cities, and they had a surgery performed to hide their circumcision, abandoned the Holy Covenant, started associating with Gentiles, and did all sorts of other evil things. And so here we see that on the one hand, we're going to see this in a minute, that Antiochus forbid anybody who wanted to do a Brit Milah or keep Shabbat or learn Torah or anything like that. We already have Hellenism that's coming from the people. And this Hellenism is not just cultural, let's be, they had surgery in order to make it look like they weren't circumcised. That's a huge, they wanted to fit in. They wanted to be able to put anything else that identified them as a Jew totally behind them, so that they were able to not just associate, but look like anybody else in the empire, any other Hellenist. And yet now we have also another element or another layer of this story. And if after that, Antiochus had been in Egypt. So this is talking about, if you remember that map, right? So Antiochus had gone down to Egypt, and now the Ptolemy area was taken over by the Seleucids. He returned again in the year 140 and 30. In the 140 and 30 year, year 143, and he went up against Israel and Jerusalem with a great multitude. And he entered proudly into the sanctuary and took away the golden altar and the candlestick of light, right? So the menorah and all of the different kelim. And when he had taken it away, he went into his own land, having made a great massacre and spoken very proudly. Therefore, there was a great mourning in Israel in every place they were. So we see the beginning of attacking the Jewish people, but it has nothing to do with their religion or their rejection of Hellenism. He's on a warring rampage. And then what do we see here? This is just a coin that I brought for you. This is actually Antiochus on the left side over here. And in Greek, what it says over here, it talks about his valiant victory. And that's supposed to be part of his boats, of his army that came down to attack and capture the Talmuds. So then we have Yosef ben Matityahu, right? Why am I bringing up Yosef ben Matityahu? Because Yosef ben Matityahu is more commonly known as Josephus. Josephus was a historian who lived in the time of the Romans, but he wrote about also the time of Hanukkah. And we're going to take a look at his source. But even looking at Yosef ben Matityahu or Josephus, we can see that he looks pretty Hellenized himself. Now, what's fascinating is that he was actually a leader in the Great Revolt, which is the revolt that ended in Chorban Bayit Sheni, in the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. And so Josephus started out as one of the leaders of this revolt, and he actually claims to be, on his father's side, descendant of Kohanei Gadol, and on his mother's side, descendant of royalty. So he's after the Hashmonaim already, but notice that as soon as he loses and he basically defects to Rome, he's kind of the Benedict Arnold, if you will, of the Jewish people, he takes on a Hellenist look. He takes on that look. You wouldn't know looking at him that he was Jewish in the way that he's dressing, in his hairstyle, etc. But so Yosef ben Matityahu, Josephus, also writes about the time of Hanukkah. Now, obviously, he lived later. We're not sure what his sources were, but what does he write? Now, Antiochus was not satisfied either with his unexpected taking the city or with its pillage or with the great slaughter he had made there. But being overcome with his violent passions and remembering what he had suffered during the siege, he compelled the Jews to dissolve the laws of their country and to keep their infants uncircumcised and to sacrifice swine's flesh upon the altar. So we see that it's not just the Hellenists' culture from within, but also, as we are very familiar with, Antiochus makes laws or decrees that Jews are not allowed to be Jewish. He is trying to completely wipe out any sort of Jewish identity and trying from two different ways. On the one hand, he's supporting the Jews who are building the theaters and, stadiums and all of the Greek culture. On the other side, he's coming with the negative saying, you're not allowed to be Jewish. So this is really what starts the story of Hanukkah. This is really what drives this conflict between the Hashmonaim and the Greeks. But the question that I think that we have begun to answer already, even before we've asked it, is this also a civil war? Because the Hashmonaim, when Matityahu HaKohen stands up and says, Mila Hashem Elai, It's not an assumption that everybody's going to follow him. There are people, especially because remember when there was war between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, the Jews were in the middle, right? Israel was in the middle. And so some Jews, they really supported the Seleucids. And some Jews, they really supported the Ptolemies. And what we saw was that the Jews that supported the Seleucids became more and more and more Hellenized as time went on. And so they weren't just supporting the Seleucids when it came to fighting the Ptolemies, they were supporting the Seleucids when it came to fighting the Jewish people. And so not only are the Hashmonaim trying to, or at this point, the Maccabees, and why do we call them the Maccabees? Because one of the theories is that they were able to kill so many people, they were called the Hammer. It's from the same Shoresh. But there are all sorts of reasons why we call them the Maccabees, right? But either way, so the Maccabees, when they're fighting, when they're trying to gain control, they're not just talking about control from a foreign entity, they're talking about control from an internal entity that is also the entity of their devotion to God and their own identity as Jews, and Eretz Yisrael's identity as a Jewish place that also follows the laws of Hashem. And so there are these two warring ideas that are going on. Now, what do we see? Unfortunately, after the Maccabees win, very, very soon afterwards, the Hashmonai kings who last until the Romans, when the Romans eventually take over, and that's a much longer historical discussion that we don't have time for, but it's very fascinating. We see that the kings become themselves, they become kings, and not just Kohanim Gadol, and they also become Hellenized. So here we have a coin. This is from Alexander Yanai. Alexander Yanai was one of the Hashmonai rulers. He actually calls himself the king. And this was a coin, incidentally, found by a high school student in Herzliya who went with her school on an archaeological dig. So that's kind of cool and really exciting for them. But on this, what we can't see in the image itself, it actually calls Alexander Yanai a melech. We know that Judaism has a sense of checks and balances where the Kohen Gadol can never be a king because they come from two different shvatim. You can't be from the line of David and also be a Kohen. It's not, they conflict. You can't have those two things happening at the same time, and yet we see that happening. And I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is that in the modern world, when we look around, there's not so much difference between us and especially the Hashmonaim, but even some of the Hellenists. How many of us go by names that are anglicized names of what our names are, or even have English names? Or how many of us will take part in the modern culture or in modern politics, etc.? And so I think that the sources, and really I know I only have a few more minutes, about 5 minutes left, I want to look at how we can learn from this story, looking at our own sources, looking at Tanakh, the things that have been canonized, that either Hashem specifically gave us or that Chazal recognized were written through Nevuah and through Ruach HaKodesh. And let's take a look at what they say. So this is obviously a very well-known phrase, V'shinamtam l'banecha v'dibartavam b'shivtecha v'veitecho v'lechtecha v'derech v'shavcha u'kumecha. So you have to, it says here, impress upon your children, right? What do you have to do? There is an idea that there is a constant vigilance in education to retell the ideals and to emphasize the ideals of Jewish people again and again and again. And so here we have the Sifri. The Sifri is a midrashic commentary on this pasuk. And what does it say? And you shall speak in them, make them the words of Torah, right? The Dibar Tabam, what is it saying? The words of Torah need to be primary, not secondary. That your dealings to be only in them, that you not intermix other words with them. That you not say, I have learned the wisdom of Israel, now I'm going to go and learn the wisdom of the Canaanites. It is therefore written to walk therein and not depart from them. And then there's a pasuk from Mishle, let them be to you alone and not to the strangers with you. And so the Sifri is already giving us one way in which to resist while still taking part. Make them the words of Torah primary and not secondary. And we see the same thing with Rav Hirsch. If we understand these sentences aright, then the sentence which stands at the head, make them primary and not subsidiary, forewarns one not to take the following sentences to mean that one is to completely ignore and remain ignorant of all knowledge and science which has been gained and nurtured by non-Jewish sources, or which have no direct bearing on the knowledge to be gained by the study of Torah. Inasmuch as what is commanded, make them the primary and not subsidiary, the permission to occupy oneself with other spheres of knowledge is assumed. Only the knowledge of Torah and the understanding that we derive from it is to be our principal concern and to be regarded as having been given to us the absolute and firmly established truth. Says Rav Hirsch, there is no expectation that we do not allow science and culture to be part of what we do and what we talk about, but we need to make sure it's the primary focus. We need to make sure that it is what we look to, what we consume ourselves with, as the number one. And I think that this fits so nicely with the message of Hanukkah, because in the message of Hanukkah, what are we doing? We're adding light to the world. We're lighting a candle in the dark, but we're also doing it in a place of chol, as opposed to doing it in a place of kodesh, like Shabbat or a lot of the other chagim. Everything is still chol. We go to work, we're allowed to turn on lights, we're allowed to do all of these things. The idea that we as the Jewish people are supposed to be a light unto the nations happens in chol, which I think is so telling in terms of what we are supposed to take from not just the story of Hanukkah, but what was going on at the time when the Jewish people who were becoming Hellenized were having surgeries to make themselves look like the Gentiles. What were they doing? They were stopping their function as light. They were stopping their function as candle. They were stopping their primary goal in the world, which is to be that reminder of ethics and morality that come from God. And they left that. And so how interesting is it, and not by coincidence, that so much of Hanukkah has to do with light, because that really is our goal. I heard the very end of the shir before with Ribbits and Smiles and the question about Rabbi Sacks. The truth is, I would have brought this quote regardless of the circumstance, but I think that with the fact of Rabbi Sacks's passing and looking at his legacy of being that person who was able to take so much from the culture around him and elevate it to make himself that beacon of light and morality, I think that he is the perfect example of what we try and live up to, but also this ideal of this history of Hanukkah that we've been talking about. For 40 centuries, Jews have held tenaciously to the belief that we have been charged with a sacred mission, to sanctify life by being God's ambassadors to a world that has all too often worshiped the multiple forms of what Nietzsche called the will to power. We were called on to write a different story that tells of the beauty of holiness and the call of compassion, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. Judaism has placed at the center of striving some of the most healing and all sacred imperatives, the importance of love and loyalty, marriage and the sacred bonds between husband and wife, parent and child, education and the life of the mind, justice, equity, the rule of law, compassion, charity, and human dignity, the bonds of belonging and community, memory, history, and imperishable hope. We seek God not just in the remote heavens or the innermost recesses of the soul, but in ordinary life with its pleasures and pains, fears and hopes, conflicts and consolations. Judaism believes not in abandoning earth for the sake of heaven, but in bringing fragments of heaven down to earth in simple deeds and celebrations, for that is where God is found, not in wealth, power, fame, success, or any other of the myriad substitutes for life, still less in violence and terror, but in life itself, living, breathing, neshama, the Hebrew word for soul meaning breathing, loving, giving, caring, praying, praising, giving thanks, defeating tragedy in the name of hope, and death in the name of life. Our task is to be true to our faith and a blessing to others because we are true to our faith. To be a Jew is to bring redemption one day at a time, one act at a time. Every mitzvah, every kind word or deed, every act of sharing what we have with others brings the divine presence into the world by recognizing the image of God in other people and helping me remake the world in the image of God. And so what the Hellenists were unable to do, or what the Hellenists, where they went wrong, was not necessarily in their desire to expand and to look at the Greek culture, but where the Greek culture clashed with Judaism, they were unwilling to leave it aside. And they stopped making the Torah primary, and they stopped having the goal of being Hashem's ambassadors in the world. And so I give us a bracha that at this Hanukkah, when the world seems so very dark for so many reasons, that we are able to be a light, not just from the lights that we're lighting, but an internal light where we focus on our goals, where we learn from history, and where we say, we can do this right. And Be'ezrat Hashem, every meeting that we have, we will bring blessing into the world. So thank you very much. I'm just looking, can I enlarge the timeline? Okay, that was the only question that we saw. Yeah, sure, I can put the quote on the screen. Oh, that's not helpful for you. One second. Share screen. Also, again, if you email me, my email is rivi@yeshisrael, yeshisrael.com. I'm happy to share the screen with any of the slideshow with anybody that wants. I'm also happy to take questions because I know we're out of time and I don't want to encroach on the presenter after me, the speaker after me. So please feel free to be in touch with questions. I'm more than happy to take them. And Chodesh Tov, everybody.